New World Report. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. To Panama, to the canal. The professor has just returned from Panama, so I look to him for fresh reporting on what I've come to understand is the banking center, not only for Central America, but for the Americas. We're looking at a very prosperous-looking city, Panama City. At the same time, there are questions raised in North America and in Europe about banks, about what is called the banking crisis on Wall Street. So I paid attention to headlines out of Panama because the banks have this magic word contagion. When anybody mentions it, they run screaming to the exits or they hide under their desks. Within these last days, given that it's an ongoing mystery as to what is to be done for the regional banks in the U.S., Credit Suisse is now no longer in existence in Europe. So what, do we have a 2008 or do we have something that's been contained? Panama ran this headline: Panama sees limited risk from U.S. European bank problems. Professor, I start there because you're back with news about Panama, which the last time you reported in, you led me to understand is stable and is looking to maintain its strong relationship with the U.S. With the bank solved, what other news do we have from Panama City?
Thank you, John. Well, as you point out, certainly the a lot of banks do business in Panama as an international banking center, but it appears that at least for the moment, you're not seeing the same type of cracks that you see with Credit Suisse. As a financial center, one of the issues that was critical in Panama, of course, is some frustration among Panamanians that the decision of the Financial Action Task Force, which helps indicate which banks are or which banking systems are more transparent or compliant, so to speak, continued to be held on the international, what they call the gray list, which imposes certain costs for Panamanian banks and others. Panamanians, many that I talked to, ironically, were blaming the French, who are seen as having played a key role in keeping the FTF from taking Panama off that gray list, despite the fact that they complied with, I believe, 13 of the 15 issues that were there. But beyond that, there's a lot of frustration, I think, with the regime of Nito Cortizo in general. There has been relatively high inflation, obviously a lot of damage coming out of the COVID-19 crisis. You saw a frustration with the high prices and difficulties in obtaining basic goods a couple months ago with a protest that led to the shutdown of the major road route that goes through the country. Right now you have the issue of the obligation of the government, which is in some financial difficulties, to gradually end some of the subsidies, which had helped to keep prices down. For example, electricity subsidies were just, they begun ending those. And so the price for Panamanians for electricity has just begun to skyrocket. Some talk about the need to end fuel subsidies soon. And in general, there is a sense of frustration, I think, that many of the projects that were hoped for by the Cortizo administration in terms of the completion of public works have been slow in getting off the ground. There is a major mining project run by a Canadian company called First Quantum. There is a legal dispute where essentially their permission to operate in Panama had to be renegotiated. And although there's a provisional agreement with the Cortizo administration last January 2022, it's been a year of back and forth to the point in which the mine was literally forced because of a government ruling to suspend its mining operations. This is a mine responsible for 5% of the Panamanian GDP and 40,000 jobs. And so I think across the board, including there's been a sense that there's a lot of corruption, in and around in public offices, including even the once relatively solid Panama Canal Authority, as well as the Maritime Authority. And so I think a lot of that frustration has people looking to the May 2024 elections and the possibility of change. And indeed, arguably, Panamanians have gotten so frustrated with the public performance as well as the corruption that the previous president, Ricardo Martinelli, who actually was indicted by the United States, he's been named as a corrupt person. His own children have literally testified to his own corruption in cases in U.S. courts as part of legal actions against them. The Panamanians say, Yeah, we know Martinelli is corrupt, but we had jobs under him. Things seem to be get done under him. So we, not unlike Lula da Silva in Brazil, we welcome him coming back. And so that level of frustration and cynicism with Panamanian politics and in performance, I think, has Panamanians. And again, this strategically important country in commercial terms and logistics terms and in financial terms and in geographic terms, looking for types of change that could make the United States uncomfortable in the coming year or two.
Given the troubles in elections everywhere, Professor, glass house, that's, I'm thinking of the proverb, glass house before you throw stones, about other people's election troubles. We go to Brazil, which you mentioned, a president who heretofore has been jailed for his bad conduct in office, Lula da Silva, now understood as a grandfatherly figure, if I understand correctly, although half of Brazil did not vote for his return to office. But Lula da Silva is now looking to lead a very critical embassy, not only for his own country, which is a dominant power in the Americas, but also for everyone to understand, how do you do business with the imperialism of Beijing and Moscow? Recently at their meeting between their two leaders in Moscow, it was very clear that both sides endorsed the violence in Ukraine and the threats to the region in East Asia, that would be Taiwan and the rest of the island chain. And yet, Lula da Silva is going next week to Beijing for business contacts. The report from Sao Paulo, more than a quarter of business leaders traveling to China with President Lula da Silva come from Brazil's booming meat industry, highlighting the high stakes for a sector reliant on Chinese demand for most of its exports. I think this is good news, Professor. I think that China's business in Brazil empowers the people of Brazil. And yet there are questions raised about many of these executives traveling with Lula da Silva, some of whom were caught up in the corruption scandals of these last years. So how to think of Lula da Silva's outreach to China, at the same time his neutrality about Ukraine?
Great question, John. I think, first of all, a lot of people, especially on the Brazilian right, looked at the PT and the concern that Lula had been in prison and maybe hardened his stance and attitudes. And so I think what we've seen is, although Lula has continued to be relatively centrist in some ways, he has certainly in his focus on leftist programs and the expansion of the state in domestic policy, he's been moving forward much more aggressively and certainly against the followers of previous Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. On the other hand, also in terms of foreign policy, the foreign ministry establishment, Itamar Chi, you've seen, I think, again, a willingness to move much more aggressively in a number of different areas in terms of Mercosur. And as you pointed out, Brazil, which has long been, obviously not only the largest country in South America, but has long seen itself as having an international role. You see that through organizations such as the BRICS, which connect Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, and China. What you see as part of that, for example, on the one hand, Lula's somewhat cynical desire in his former meeting with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, saying, okay, no, we're not going to find Russia to blame. We see Zelensky and Putin equally to blame here. And what Brazil is really trying to do is position itself to negotiate some sort of peace, or at least have a role in that, just in the same way that it tried unsuccessfully to position itself to have a role in brokering a nuclear deal between the United States and Canada, or the United States and Iran, the last time that Lula was in power. But the other key piece of that is of course, the critical relationship between Brazil and China. China's the number one trading partner for Brazil, and it's number one investor. Indeed, $70 billion over the past 20 years of Chinese investment has gone into Brazil, which is over 40% of total Chinese investment going into the Americas in general. It is a broad ranging investment. It's in the agricultural sector, and indeed something like a quarter of the entire enormous Lula delegation of 250 people are from agriculture. Something like 90 are from the meat sector alone. 90 are from the agricultural sector in general. You also have Chinese involved in manufacturing, in the telecommunications sector, in the port sector, in fintech. critical materials, a company called CBMM. And so certainly Lula going over there right now, there is going to be a political dimension and a strategic dimension, which is really cementing that what they call a strategic partnership that Brazil and China have had since 1993, and looking for ways in which maybe they can collaborate on issues such as the Ukraine, which again elevates Lula's importance and Brazil's importance as they support a Chinese role in that peace initiative. But it's also about economics. Lula is hoping to get an end to some of the restrictive agricultural requirements, which have caused a dramatic fall in Brazilian beef exports to China recently, but also looking for, to open up the market for, more exports of Brazilian corn, more exports, more Chinese investment in sectors like oil and mining and things like that. So there's really just a wide ranging agenda. And it really emphasizes just how important China is to Brazil. I often say, Lula came to Washington, D.C. not too long ago, and they ended up talking about social policy. And the environment, really Lula is going to China to talk about strategic collaboration and to talk about doing business in multi-billion-dollar ways.
If I could imagine a world of 2050, which I do doubt very much I will see, it would include this way of dividing up the globe, not about warring blocks in Europe, but about global South and global North. And if I were to imagine the global South looking for leadership, Brazil and India would be my first two choices, both members of BRICS. I perhaps have read the wrong material, Professor, but the BRICS strikes me as a transnational organization for the future, not for the present, not involved in arms manufacturing or frontline watching or drone manufacturing, but involved in food security and at the same time dealing with the sharp climate changes we know are upon us. Is that something that is recognizable to you, that the Global South will look for leaders and Brazil is certainly a nominee?
Well, ironically, John, the BRICS were initially basically an investment company stock pick, trying to put together those big, relatively vibrant countries that were worth looking at for investors. But with time, it took on a new reality as a political entity. But for the same reasons that it was made that initial analyst pick, yet the countries do tend to be relevant. And as you point out, they are all in some ways part of the Global South. Of course, Russia has moved away from, seeming role as a new player in the South and has moved in a much more, aggressive, direction. And you do have important differences in position between each of the actors. But certainly there's an attempt by the BRICS, and that was one of the reasons why they created a political entity and even a bank, this new development bank around the idea of BRICS. There's an idea to reach across regions and to really to use it as a tool of kind of South-South solidarity. It dovetails nicely with what the Chinese call their new global development initiative, where they want to also return to the roots of South-South relations. So I'd say that all of the countries in question have their issues in different ways. I would be reluctant to say that the BRICS countries are in some ways, less armed or less aggressive. I mean, certainly you have to look at the case of Russia and China embracing Russian aggression. But there is clearly a political component, and it represents the increasing political salience of the Global South in this new world order. And so in that world of 2050, and we certainly, I certainly hope that you and I will both be here in 2050. But I think the relevance of the Global South, as represented by some of those key countries, is certainly one of the stories that's shaping that future.
We'll continue to play this game, competing with Philip K. Dick, trying to imagine a future we might not live in. Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. We're headed to one of the most powerful and new players in all of the Americas, Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, complaining about violence. This is CBS Eye on the World, the New World Report, with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.